Good morning. This is James Stevenson with the World News Roundup. And this morning, following my report from the NBC newsroom in New York, we expect to hear from our overseas observers in London and Manila. In addition, we will get our usual report from the nation's capital, and this morning a special report from W.W. Chaplin, who's here with me in the New York newsroom. But first, here's a summary of the day's important news. Anti-British rioting continues in Bombay today for the third successive day, despite surrender of the Indian Navy personnel whose mutiny started the trouble earlier in the week. And while casualty figures mount, Mahatma Gandhi, leader of India's Untouchables, has called on his people to stop the violence. Anti-Russian demonstrations are reported from several of China's larger cities today as the Red Army celebrates its 28th anniversary. At Manila, Japanese General Yamashita and two of his subordinate officers today were hanged in disgrace for war crimes and atrocities. Here at home, the nation's industrial picture is still gloomy today, with but little hopes for improvement over the weekend, while John L. Lewis, with the possible support of the American Federation of Labor, may soon start an all-out attack on the administration's new wage price policy. Those are today's major news headlines. In a moment, I'll call in NBC observers for their first-hand accounts.
Wanted. Apartment or house to rent or buy. Any location. Urgent. You've seen hundreds of such ads in your daily papers, most of them placed by veterans. Unfortunately, few of them are being answered, simply because there are few, if any, vacancies available anywhere. These men, desperately in search of a place to live, are the same men who gave up their homes to fight for their country. They deserve your help and consideration. With this in mind, you can cooperate by staying where you are for the time being to permit veterans with no homes to find a vacancy, by sharing your home with a veteran and his family where possible, and by listing vacancies and houses for sale at the Veterans Housing Referral Service in your community. Do your share. Help these men find a place to live. And again, here is James Stevenson.
The negotiators in the General Motors strike will meet in Detroit today for their ninth consecutive session, following a report they had agreed tentatively on one major point. According to James E. Dewey, the Special Federal Labor Mediator, the company and union have reached an understanding on the auto workers' demand for maintenance of membership, but that the understanding hinges on agreement on other points still in dispute. No progress has been made on wage demands, employee promotions and transfers, vacation with pay and several other issues. Meanwhile, a government mediator is seeking a federal intervention in Detroit after the striking dairy workers turned down a company proposal to end the walkout, which has curtailed milk supplies for 2 million persons in the auto city. 30 miles south of Manila today, under floodlights and a cool Pacific dawn, the former Japanese Tiger of Malaya, Lieutenant General Yamashita, walked to a gallows in a cane field and was hanged in disgrace. For a first-hand account, we switch now to NBC in Manila.
Come in, NBC in Manila. Come in, NBC in Manila. Come in, NBC in Manila. Come in, please, NBC in Manila. We're sorry, but due to conditions beyond our control, we are unable to bring you this portion of our program. We return you now to the NBC newsroom in New York.
Again, this is James Stevenson in New York. And returning to our story on General Yamashita. His last words before he was hanged were a prayer for the Emperor's long life. Two of his subordinates, Lieutenant Colonel Seiichi Ota, former commander of the Japanese military police in the Philippines, and Taguma Higashiji, a civilian interpreter, also convicted of atrocities, were hanged a few minutes after Yamashita. Yamashita was just an old man when he walked to the gallows. He had been stripped of his uniform and all military insignia and medals. He wore an American Army khaki trousers and shirt. And now we switch to NBC in London.
This is Merrill Muller reporting from London. A public opinion survey conducted by Britain's largest morning newspaper, the Daily Express, shows today that the average Englishman is quite prepared to borrow $4 billion from the United States with reservations and at American expense. This poll, taken among people representing a cross-section of British life and including members of the three major political parties, Liberal, Socialist, and Conservative, showed 61% of the public in favor of the American loan. This is ironical because the newspaper which conducted the poll has also been conducting a powerful editorial campaign against any loans from America, arguing that Britain can live by imperial preference. That point, imperial preference, is powerfully supported by the poll. The same people who approved the American loan also disapproved, by 81%, of any trade concessions to America which would weaken imperial preference. In other words, they are quite prepared here to borrow American money at what is considered a high interest rate, and equally ready to freeze America out of some of the major trade markets of the world, those known as the imperial preference and sterling areas. Having thus considered two ways to weaken the American economic position by a huge debt and stymied trade, the members of the British public participating in the poll then considered the International Monetary Fund known as Bretton Woods. They were evenly divided on whether they should participate in the world's financial clearinghouse, 29% approved and 29% disapproved, and 42% claimed they didn't know which way Britain should turn. The poll has another interesting highlight in its bleak statistical tables. It shows that only 28% of the British public are willing to suffer several more years of austerity living in order to do without the American loan, which, these people have been told, will bring them a few of the comforts of life that have been so painfully earned. It also shows that despite this country's consistently patriotic Buy British campaigns at home and abroad, there is a measure of enlightenment creeping in that accepts the principle of free trade means more trade. 10% of the public voted against imperial preferences, presumably on the ground that in due time it would throttle world economics, bring the British financial position tumbling down, and carry America and the world with it. If this poll is then the criterion, 65% of these people want to borrow your money, and 81% of them want to restrict your trade. This is Merrill Muller switching you to NBC in Washington.
Leafing in Washington. And this morning, while Chester Bowles is busy figuring out how much more we ought to pay for our lamb chops so the packing house workers can have their wages raised, Senator Al McThomas says meat is going to get cheaper. Of course, disagreement between the Hill and downtown isn't exactly a novelty in Washington. But here we have Bowles and Thomas stepping into each other's shoes. Bowles, the hold-the-liner, working out higher prices for meat to start the industry off on a new post-war basis. Thomas, a farm block, high price, and easy money man, if there ever was one, predicting cheaper meat. Thomas takes a look at the nation's herds and says the same thing that's happened to chicken is going to happen to beef and lamb. He says there's a world of meat in the country, and the Agriculture Department is encouraging slaughter because of short feed supplies. Of course, that means only that meat prices would drop until the herds are trimmed down to fit the size of the national feed bin, and then they jump beyond their wartime level. For the labor situation this morning, Washington's wondering whether John L. Lewis and his miners are out to smash the president's latest wage price policy. Lewis doesn't say so in so many words, but he does say, certainly the miners will expect their problems to be settled on the merits of the questions affecting the coal industry, which certainly doesn't sound like any solid endorsement of the president's policy. Lewis and the rest of the AFL men look on the policy as a body blow at free collective bargaining, and predict that higher prices will outrun higher wages. Incidentally, the slide rule men over at the Labor Department figure the soft coal miners are the second best paid of industrial workers, averaging over $55 a week. I return you now to the NBC newsroom in New York.
And again, this is James Stevenson. One of the great problems of America's millions of servicemen and women is what to do when they return to civilian life. Many of them feel they are fitted for other and perhaps better work than that which they left when they joined the service. Whether to go back to the old trade or use their new abilities is their problem. And here is W.W. Chaplin to report on this very important subject.
Thank you, Jim. A lot of men have come out of the services to find their chosen fields already overcrowded. Conventional aviation is perhaps typical. How can thousands of pilots, maintenance, and administrative men of the service air forces all find places in the aviation structure? Some of the aviation ex-servicemen have already shown what can be done and set an example for their buddies interested in other crowded industries. The answer of these men is that if a field is overcrowded, broaden the field. And so the charter air cargo, the air freight, as against the established scheduled air passenger and air express business, has come into being. Hundreds are already engaged in this new business. At least half a dozen such companies have been formed. The Flying Tigers, Air Cargo Transport, Air Transport Corporation, Hoosier Air Freight Corporation, undoubtedly others. Most are still in the organization and equipment stage, but the first all-freight airline, ACT, has already shown that it can be done. ACT, which has been operating out of Newark for months, is in the news today because it has just signed a contract to fly 10,000 copies of the New York Times, a full plane load, to Washington every night. The record of this company is an example and inspiration to other following in the same field. Formed by H. Roy Penzel, who flew submarine watch for the Civil Air Patrol out of Miami during the war, it now has 10 former Army C-47 transports in operation, with others on order. President Penzel picked an operations chief from the Army Transport Command in Karachi, India, his chief weatherman from Army Meteorology in the Aleutians, his pilots from all the services, and he went to Selective Service for advice on his maintenance men. Even his public relations man is a war correspondent from the CBI. If you wonder how ex-servicemen can start a cargo airline, here's how it's done. They pool what money they have or can borrow and buy one plane from Army surplus. A C-47 transport that the Army paid $95,000 for is being sold by the Army today for $20,000. With operation begun, freight contracts signed, further financing is relatively simple and expansion can be speedy. Cost to shippers can be brought as low as 20 cents a ton mile, which is something for earthbound freight lines to worry about. ACT cargo so far have included fish, fresh fruit, flowers, lobsters, penicillin. Those, of course, all need refrigeration. But the air cargo boys don't have to install expensive freeze equipment. They merely fly high and get their refrigeration free for nothing from nature. And now, James Stevenson.
The World News Roundup today has brought you Merrill Muller in London, Leif Eade in Washington, and W.W. Chaplin in the New York newsroom. We're very sorry we could not bring you a direct broadcast from Manila as we had scheduled. I'll be back with more news in just a moment, but in the meantime, your announcer has this to say.
All of us want an America that offers security, opportunity, and peace for ourselves, our neighbors, and our children. We fought hard for these objectives through a tragic war, but now that the shooting has stopped, we are assuming the battle is won. Unfortunately, it is far from won. The most important battle still remains to be fought. The battle against inflation and economic chaos. We can lose that battle, and with it everything for which we have struggled so hard. But we can win it, too, if we all do our part. How? Mainly by using our common sense. Remember these simple rules. Buy sensibly and buy only what you really need. Refuse to pay over ceiling prices. Report those who violate price ceilings. Don't patronize the black market, and discourage everyone you know from patronizing it. Perhaps these rules seem obvious, but by ignoring them, we invite defeat. Remember, the battle against inflation can be won, but it can also be lost. It all depends on you. Now back to James Stevenson in the NBC newsroom in New York.
Argentina's violent presidential campaign ended today as more than 3 million voters prepared to vote tomorrow in the nation's first general election since 1937. Both candidates, Colonel Juan de Perón, former vice president who was supported by the military clique and the Labor Party, and José P. Tamburini, who has the backing of a four-party leftist coalition known as the Democratic Union, expressed confidence in victory. Meanwhile, soldiers and police patrolled downtown streets of Buenos Aires, keeping a close watch on the crowds. The presidential campaign has been marked by frequent demonstrations and bloodshed, and it moved toward a dramatic climax last night when Colonel Perón warned that if there were any election fraud, violence would result, which would be remembered for centuries. And at the same time, police announced the arrest of at least 14 men, some of whom were identified as communists in a terroristic plot. And that's the World News Roundup for this morning of February 23rd. This is James Stevenson in the NBC Newsroom in New York, and I'll be seeing you Monday morning.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.